Drive Time on RT Radio 1, sponsored by Zurich. When it comes to pensions, performance counts. Speak to a financial broker about a Zurich pension.
Drive Time on RTE Radio 1.
Hamas launched a barrage of rockets and sent a wave of fighters who gunned down civilians.
A shocking hostage taking of more than 100 Israelis.
The military pounded the Palestinian enclave with airstrikes in the last 24 hours.
Now we argue about how many people are killed. I know the names of those people who were killed.
Hamas is using the houses of civilians in Gaza so he can shoot 1,000 missiles a day.
Electricity, food, water and gas supplies have been cut off.
Everything is running short, including the fuel for the generators.
Ask us, Israeli, forgive our enemy fuel, they will abuse
they're
it.
They're fighting for war, they're fighting each other.
This is Israel's 9/11.
On October 7th, Hamas militants stormed across the Israeli border with Gaza. The attack killed 1,200 people and 251 were taken hostage. In response, Israel launched a military bombardment of Gaza. Palestinian health authorities say Israel's military campaign in Gaza has killed almost 42,000 people, mostly civilians, over the past year and driven most of Gaza's 2.3 million people from their homes.
Over four programmes will chronicle the year's events from the Hamas attack to the ongoing war in Gaza and the real risk of Middle East conflict in the wider region. In this second episode, we focus on the fourth to sixth month of the conflict, from February to April.
During this time, the Israeli government planned to launch a military operation in the southern Gazan city of Rafah, which would trigger mass evacuation of the already displaced civilian population.
By March, the civilian death toll surpasses 30,000. There was widespread warnings of famine in the territory by April, while the suspension of UNRWA funding by the US and others hampered humanitarian aid responses.
While attacks on shipping by the Yemeni Houthis in the Red Sea and missile attacks by the US and UK in Yemen further heightened regional tensions.
This is part two of the war in Gaza.
As early as January 2024, there were high-level warnings that famine was looming in Gaza, like this interview with UN Special Rapporteur Michael Fakhry, who'd never seen a population made to go hungry so quickly.
I'm joined now by Michael Fakhry, who's a UN Special Rapporteur on the right to food from his home in Oregon. Okay, so as an independent expert then, what you've been saying is that since UNRWA has lost funding because of the Hamas allegations recently, that the Gaza Strip is facing inevitable famine. Is that right?
That's exactly what I announced recently, because we have to look at the situation right before UNRWA lost its funding. Every single person in Gaza is hungry. One quarter of the population are starving. And at the time, we said that famine was imminent. And so if you were to look globally at all the people in the whole world facing famine, 80% of those people were found in Gaza. So when this announcement arose that UNRWA was going to lose funding, immediately this raised alarm bells across the humanitarian system all over the world.
You've said that it's inevitable then, and you've also said that you've never seen a civilian population go hungry so quickly.
Exactly. I mean, and this is so unfortunate that I've been talking to people in Gaza, to humanitarian workers, to people at the highest levels at different UN humanitarian agencies. And the consensus is we've never seen a population made to go hungry so quickly and so completely. We're talking about 2.2, 2.3 million people, over half of which are children, are being pushed into hunger and this is basically collective punishment. These are all civilians. And what we're hearing about UNRWA is these are allegations about 12 people in this organization that serves 1.7 million people. So this is yet another form of collective punishment against the Palestinian people.
You think it's a form of collective punishment to stop funding? Is that it? Would you go so far as to say, Michael, that these people are being deliberately starved?
Starvation in any situation throughout history is always the result of political choices. It's never a surprise, and it's never unexpected when it happens. Starvation always comes from the result of politicians and people with power making clear choices, and this is no different.
That sounds like a yes.
That's a very long-winded yes.
we spoke with an Israeli spokesperson for the Israeli government on this program recently, and he said that there's no need for allegations of want of aid or want of food in Gaza, because that Israel allows... the problem is that they can't distribute the aid agency's aid as quickly as Israel is allowing it in.
I mean, so let's look at the context of the situation. Before the war in Gaza, 50% of people were food insecure and 80% relied on humanitarian aid. The majority of that aid actually went through UNRWA. So 1.2 million people in Gaza were relying on UNRWA before the war. As soon as the war in Gaza happened in October, immediately the entire population was relying on UNRWA schools, hospitals, and social services. And people were sheltering in schools, and UNRWA was, in the end, distributing free flour, supporting 89 bakeries, and was trying to get bread to 1.7 million people. Mm-hmm. UNRWA has been in operation since 1949, 1950. It knows how to distribute food. It is embedded in everyday life in Gaza. What we see now is humanitarian relief is just trickling at the border. On October 9th, the Israeli Ministry of Defense announced a total siege, blocking all food, fuel, and medicine into Gaza. Now it's barely a trickle at the border. All UN agencies, whether it's UNRWA or otherwise, have been saying we're not getting enough supplies at the border, and it's no different now. So to cut off the primary aid agency in the heart of Gaza today is really cruelty at its most vicious.
The threat of regional spread of the conflict has been a concern since October 7th. There were continual attacks on shipping by the Yemeni Houthis in the Red Sea and subsequent missile attacks by the US and the UK in Yemen. In late January, three US troops were killed by a drone attack by an Iraqi-based group. It provoked an angry response from the US government.
As the bodies of three American soldiers are returned to the U.S. today, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has promised a multi-tiered response to those the U.S. holds responsible. These are the first American military deaths since the Israel-Hamas war began on October the 7th, and the expected retaliation has created significant fears of a wider escalation of the conflict in the Middle East. Well, earlier I spoke with Major General Patrick S. Ryder, who's press spokesperson for the Pentagon, and I began by asking him what the U.S. response would be.
Three of our service members were unfortunately killed over the weekend, over 40 U.S. military members wounded in an attack by an Iranian proxy drone, which struck a facility on the border with Syria in northeast Jordan. And as you've heard our president and our secretary of defense say, we will respond in a time and manner of our choosing. I'm not going to telegraph what exactly that could look like for operation security reasons, obviously, but it will be multi-tiered and it will be intended to hold those responsible for this attack accountable.
So the balance, according to many commentators, is to send a signal that the U.S. won't accept attacks of this nature, but not to trigger all-out war with Iran. Is that right?
Well, that's exactly right. And I think it's important to remember why U.S. forces are there in the first place. They have been there in support of the International Coalition for the Lasting Defeat of ISIS. If you recall, it was only 10 years ago that ISIS was on the doorsteps of Baghdad. They controlled large swaths of Syria and Iraq. And thanks to the efforts of the international community to include the United States, we've been able to put ISIS on its back foot. So that remains our focus in the region. But unfortunately, and it's not the first time we've seen these Iranian proxy groups attempting to exploit international tensions, and in this case, attack U.S. forces over 160 times through drones and rockets. And so we are focused on regional security and stability. We do not want to see escalation, but we also will not tolerate attacks against our forces.
On April 1st, Israel conducted an airstrike on the Iranian embassy in Damascus, killing 16 people, including senior Islamic Revolutionary Guard members. Here's the Iranian charge d'affaires speaking with us about the threat of wider regional conflict.
Iran has vowed to take revenge on Israel for killing its commanders who were hit earlier this month during a strike on the Iranian embassy in Damascus. For reaction to this, I'm joined in studio now by Kazim Sharif Kazimi, chargé d'affaires of the Iranian embassy to Ireland. Mr. Kazimi, you're very welcome to the programme. Let's go straight to the possibility of a strike today by Iran on Israel. Is it possible? Could it happen?
Israelis attacks Iranian embassy in the Damascus violations the international law and the Vienna Convention 1961. Iran gave the international community and Security Council more than 10 days to have condemns that and give a meaningful action to the Israeli to stop this kind of the violation. Because of the act of the United States, UK and France, no condemnations by the Security Council. And in this atmosphere, Iran has the right to reserve based off the international law, take a countermeasure based off the international law, and to be able to help the peace and security of the region and international atmosphere in this regard.
Isn't it correct to say that Iran isn't completely innocent here either? Because Israel would say that Iran uses proxies all the time, like Hezbollah and indeed Hamas, to strike Israel. They feel under threat consistently because of Iran-backed proxies.
It is a ridiculous claim. They are a resistance group where there is an occupation, there is a resistance group too, not in the just in the occupied Palestine, in the island history, in the Latin America, everywhere.
If was the attack colonial power, the seventh resistance.
If colonial powers occupies somewhere, the resistance group will come. Iran, like many countries.
While the Rafah offensive still hadn't happened by the end of March, there were still many deadly strikes by Israeli forces in Gaza. Here, Irish citizen Shireen Asabag outlines the horrific toll the attacks had on her family, friends and neighbours.
Shireen is an Irish citizen who's been living here for 15 years, but her 73-year-old mother, her brother and three nieces and nephew are trapped in Gaza City, where the area around their home has been caught in Israeli airstrikes. Just before we came on air, I spoke with Shireen about attacks to the area overnight and her own family's attempt to get to safety. I started by asking her what happened at their home near the Al-Shifa Hospital in East Gaza last night.
Yesterday evening was a really horrible night and time for my family, as the neighbor's home directly across the street was hit by an Israeli airstrike. The house has completely collapsed. The name of the family was the Skaik family, and they lived in that house. It's likely that all of the family have been killed, or at least are trapped under the rubble. This family are friends of my family, and my family and also this Skaik family are all innocent civilians. So this morning, I was in contact with my family all during the night last night, because as I said, it was a really, really tough night. There were Israeli airstrikes everywhere during the night. So two apartment blocks across the road beside the Skaik family home were hit by Israeli airstrikes with many people inside. And those blocks lived the Jaber family and the Rajab family. The buildings are completely destroyed. So many people were probably killed by the airstrikes. Maybe some are alive under the rubble, but the Israeli forces have not allowed the Red Cross to get to them. So there was also, of course, further damage to my family home from those airstrikes.
Can I ask you about your own family as well, who have been trapped in your family home? And the home was shelled, you told us last week. What situation are they in now? Are they still there?
So around 7 a.m. this morning, Irish time, my family and one other neighbouring family decided to leave together, carrying white flags. My brother decided that he would walk with his three daughters, aged 16, 7 and 6. And his wife would walk with my mother and also my 18-year-old nephew, their son. Because my mother is 73 and can't walk far, so they plan to walk east a bit to a safer place. And then again, because my mother would need to rest, she's 73 again.
Yeah.
So I got another call at 9 a.m. The family couldn't leave yet because there were two Israeli tanks on the street outside their homes. Later, my family joined the neighbors. The neighbors had already contacted Red Cross to see if they could give them some protection. But of course, the Red Cross said that they can't because the Israeli won't allow them to do anything. So they had to, the families had to leave with no protection. Then after 11 o'clock today, my 16-year-old niece phoned me to say they have arrived safely at the home of my sister-in-law's family. It is a bit safer there, so they will rest a bit and maybe more again later if it seems safe. My niece was really crying on the phone because she told me that all of her friends who lived in the three buildings across the road have been bombed earlier, have been killed. I am so relieved that my family have survived so far, I have to say. My mother told me this morning that she was afraid that she would be killed in the street. She was afraid that nobody would be able to bury her and that her body would be eaten by dogs and cats, as is happening to so many of my people in Gaza.
By the beginning of April, there were only 10 functioning hospitals left in Gaza. Here, Med Global medic Naheen Nahmed tells us about the toll on the civilian population from April 4th.
Now, hospitals and medical facilities, which have been caught up in intense fighting in Gaza, are at a crisis point. Dr. Naheen Ahmed is a pulmonary and critical care doctor and the medical director of the humanitarian aid group Med Global. She recently returned from a two-week volunteer trip to Gaza, where she says these crises are growing rapidly. Can you tell us about the latest trip?
Yes, thank you so much for having me. this was my second trip to Gaza since the war has started. I was there in January and spent about 2.5 weeks at Nasser Hospital right before the siege happened. And it's an important point to mention that because on my second trip back, most recently, the number of functional hospitals, or really rather partially functional hospitals, has reduced significantly. And in fact, currently, all across Gaza, there are only 10 partially functioning hospitals. The last time I was in Gaza, even just a few weeks back, that number was 12. So as time moves on and this crisis continues, this war continues, the number of partially and not even fully functional hospitals continues to reduce. The situation in every hospital, because of the fact that there are so many patients that are in need, and that's from patients who have chronic medical diseases that have not been able to get regular care, to patients who are injured from traumatic injuries, air missile strikes, things like that. And the hospitals are overwhelmed. They're overwhelmed with patients. There are people sleeping in the hallways because that's where people believe that they might be safe. And space is extremely limited. And so this is just kind of the scene that you see. And of course, you know, having spent time in the emergency room and in the ICU of some of these hospitals, it's an overwhelmingly high number of children that we're seeing as well.
And can you tell me what sort of injuries you're seeing children coming into the hospital with?
Yeah, it's a combination of things. You know, we see injuries from what's called blast injury. And this is when the blast wave from a missile strike is so strong that it can injure and cause internal injury for anyone. And so we, you know, one of the worst nights that I remember and recall was when we had pronounced, I think it was a total of 7 children that were dead on arrival. And this was all from blast injury with internal bleeding.
Ireland's stance on the Israeli-Gaza war and the plan to recognise Palestinian statehood drew a negative reaction from the Israeli government. Israeli government spokesperson Raquel Karamson gave us the government response on April 11th.
The government has today rejected criticism of Simon Harris, the Taoiseach, by the Israeli Foreign Ministry over his first Dáil speech as Taoiseach for not specifically mentioning the Israeli hostages in Gaza. I'm joined now from Tel Aviv by a spokesperson for the Israeli government, Raquel Karamson. Raquel, you're very welcome indeed to the programme. We heard those reports today that your foreign ministry is expressing fury, to be fair, over the Irish government's intention to give formal recognition to a Palestinian state. Might you expand for me on what the objections are to the government's intentions?
Our objections are, first of all, what happened about 6 months ago is a horrific, horrific, horrific atrocity that has not occurred in this level to the Jewish people, but to the state of Israel in our history. And I think, you know, we still have 133 hostages being held in Gaza. They have never been seen by the Red Cross in all of this 6 months. Mm-hmm. So the situation for us is very grave, and it is, you know, it's the daily crimes against humanity by Hamas that they commit daily is unbelievable. And any negotiation talks, you know, for a ceasefire, anything must include unconditional release of the hostage. And I think that is where the, you know, outrage might be, that this situation is a grave situation for our citizens. And we just feel that, you know.
Are you saying that hasn't been recognized enough by the Irish state?
I'm saying in regards to what they were referring to with this statement, I guess they felt with this statement that it wasn't mentioned in the way it should be. And in general,
but the Hamas attack of October the 7th was mentioned in the speech that the foreign ministry in Israel is referring to. I have the quote for you if you wish. We have not been silenced. The Taoiseach says, we have not been silent on the unforgivable terrorist actions of Hamas on the 7th of October.
Their fury is, especially in regards to recognizing a Palestinian state, within the current state of what's going on with the Palestinians, the current climate in Gaza and the current state of Palestinian affairs, this is absolutely no time to be focusing on possibly recognizing any Palestinian state.
There's when would a good time be? Because you've rejected that for some time now, a Palestinian state.
Actually, we have come to the negotiating table quite a few times, 5 or 6 times in the last number of years, to negotiate with the Palestinians and to make great concessions on our side.
But your Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, has rejected a two-state solution now and any statehood for the Palestinian people. Don't they have a right to statehood?
The Palestinian people have a right to statehood. The current state of affairs in Gaza and the current climate within the Palestinian, either whether it's the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank or leadership in Gaza for the Palestinian people. Currently, Hamas is still in the leadership role in Gaza. They were elected in one election. There were never any other elections. But at the same time, they're still, quote unquote, the leadership of the Palestinian people.
And you're critical of the Irish government's moves to recognize a Palestinian state. You're also critical of the new Taoiseach Simon Harris's first speech. Can I ask you, Rachela, is the Israeli government targeting Ireland along with Spain and Malta and Belgium and Slovenia and Norway because those countries are backing an initiative to give formal recognition to a Palestinian state? Is that what's behind all of this?
Targeting these countries, I think what we're expressing here is our, frankly, outrage at the fact that this is the conversation that is being talked about right now. Like I said, we still have 133 people still being held in Gaza.
We sat down with Pentagon spokesman Major General Patrick Ryder for this episode to ask him to reflect on the US response to the war in Gaza and the humanitarian response to the plight of the civilian population.
All the while, Major General, the people of Gaza suffer ongoing daily death, starvation, the spread of disease, inadequate health and humanitarian facility as well. And some have questioned the US efforts to bring further humanitarian aid to the people of Gaza. Now, the floating pier was in use, that the US helped build, was in use between May and July, and then it was dismantled. Some people say that the US humanitarian effort in Gaza has been a failure to date.
Yeah, I would really actually push back pretty strongly on that. I mean, I think the United States, and we're certainly not the only country involved, but the United States has been the largest donor of humanitarian assistance to Gaza, working side by side with the international community to get aid there. The floating pier, you know, we always said it was going to be temporary, and it was a measure, an additive measure, as we continued to see land routes be blocked off And so, you know, a significant amount of aid, much more so than you could provide via air, was able to be transferred into Gaza. But to your point, you know, the suffering in Gaza needs to stop. And this is why a ceasefire and the release of the hostages is so important. And this is why you're going to continue to see us work very, very diligently toward that end.
What would you say finally then, Major General, to people who would raise an eyebrow at that response and would say that, yes, there is a great amount of US aid being donated to the people of Gaza, but that's frustrated at the border by Israel. And equally, there's a huge amount of US weapons being supplied to Israel, which is causing that that suffering.
Well, again, I you know, fully appreciate the frustration out there. And as I mentioned, the conflict in Gaza is tragic. But as we've seen by the actions of Lebanese Hezbollah, by Iran on April 13 and 14, and by the Houthis, the Israelis face a significant number of threats. And so the U.S. is focused on the defense of Israel. You know, you and I have talked about this in the past. Mm-hmm. That is our focus, is on enabling them to defend themselves. By no means do we condone the targeting or killing of innocent civilians, and that's something we've been very clear about publicly and privately with our Israeli counterparts. The last thing I'd say on that, again, is just highlighting the complexity of this and not making excuses. But you have an adversary in Hamas that has embedded itself willfully among civilian infrastructure, schools, mosques, hospitals, including building a tunnel network underneath Gaza that's almost the size of New York City. You know, when one questions why you would expend funds on that versus supporting the people that you purportedly represent. So it just all adds to the complexity of the situation. But again, ultimately, we think the key here is a ceasefire and the release of the hostages as soon as possible.
Thank you for listening to episode 2 of Drive Time in Depth, The War in Gaza. In the next episode, we track the 7th to the 9th month of the war, with Rafah still threatened by a ground invasion, widespread displacement of Gaza's population, ceasefire talks prove fruitless, and the International Criminal Court deliberates over the conduct of Israel in Gaza.
The War in Gaza is produced by Drive Time series producer Will Hannafin and presented by me, Sarah McInerney.
And me, Cormac O'Hara.